This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio EcoShock, Joe Rome
set the all-time record for the hottest summer for any state in both Texas and Oklahoma, blowing out the record that had been set during the Dust Bowl era.
Jeff Masters.
Fasten your seatbelts, we're in for a wild ride.
A bit of ABC News.
Today in Pass Christian, Mississippi, they're already spraying for mosquitoes. There was no winter frost to kill their eggs.
Raymond DeYoung.
You begin to realize that we're not going to have to get people to consume less resources. They're going to be consuming less resources, whether they're ready or not.
And climate scientist.
A clean coal lobbyist.
No!
A cast up alarmist.
No!
A climate scientist. Yo!
You asked for it. It's 2012, and my email box is filled with listeners saying, what the heck is going on with summer in March? They're in their bathing suits, on the beach, in the Maritimes, on the Great Lakes, and down the East Coast. I'll ask the experts, Joe Rome from Climate Progress and Jeff Masters from the Weather Underground. Then we visit with Professor Raymond DeYoung. What state of mind do you need to cope when the future rolls in much too fast?
Radio EcoShock.
When we get exciting weather, it's hard to beat the Dr. Jeff Masters blog at the Weather Underground. Jeff has taught meteorology, he's been a hurricane hunter for NOAA, and he still watches storms and all forms of strange weather. Jeff, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
I just love your blog, and especially your recent post on the temperature record set this March. We have listeners all over the U.S. and Canada, so go ahead. Can you give us some of the highlights measured around North America?
Yeah, this heat wave, I hesitate to call it a heat wave because it was just warm, but relative to average, the U.S. and Canada have never seen an event this extreme. The records that were not only broken but smashed, it just boggled my mind. I mean, we had a couple temperature records smashed by 30 degrees. I mean, these are records that had stood for over 50 years. It's hard enough to break a record by, say, 10 degrees, but that was commonplace during this heat event. And a lot of places were breaking them by more than 20 degrees, and like I said, a few 30-degree records. And on top of that, not only did some locations set records for the hottest March temperature, but those records in March were breaking the April record for heat. So really an unusually hot spell of weather we had, and incredibly long-lasting. I mean, we had some stations that went 9 or 10 days in a row breaking the all-time record for that particular date, and that's extremely unusual to get that kind of a long run of record-breaking heat.
And some of the low temperatures beat the previous highs for that date, I understand?
Yeah, that's right. We did see a couple cases where at midnight, these stations were breaking their previous record high for the date. And not only that, but it stayed warm enough for the entire day that they ended up where their low temperature was setting the mark for a new record high. So four stations I saw do that.
Are there any particular places that stick out in your mind?
The one that boggled my mind the most was in Canada, in Nova Scotia. They had a station there that broke their previous record for the date by 33.5 degrees Fahrenheit, which is just pretty unimaginable. I mean, it got up to 85 degrees there, and it had never been above the low 50s there before. So extremely unusual heat wave.
Well, you know, I resisted covering this story just because I don't like to confuse weather with long-term climate change, but I did get dozens of emails from listeners saying, what is going on, including one from an iPhone on a beach in Nova Scotia. They're out there with their bathing suits, you know? Crazy stuff.
Yeah, that is crazy stuff. This was summer. I mean, you talk about the average highs in summer, and for a period of about a week, we had summer-like temperatures over a huge portion of both the U.S. and Canada.
And you also gave your blog readers the big picture impacts of what you called summer in March 2012. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, if you're looking for impacts for this sort of unusual weather event, there are both positive and negative impacts. Now, obviously, for positive impacts, we had a savings in money as far as heating costs go, although I was running my air conditioner here in Michigan, which I'm ashamed to admit here in March. A lot of savings on snow removal, savings because not as many people were crashing their cars on icy roads. So I think it was probably a net benefit to the economy to have this nice stretch of warm weather. But if you want to look at the negative side, we've got a situation here in Michigan tonight where we're going to get a freeze, and we're going to get an even deeper freeze tomorrow night. The growing season has started here 5 weeks early, and there are a large number of fruit trees, particularly apples and cherries, that are in full bloom right now, and we're expecting widespread damage to these fruit crops. When you freeze off the buds on these trees, they can't generate fruit that year. So I would expect we're going to see at least a 50% loss in fruit in a lot of affected orchards here, not only in Michigan, but Ohio is looking at a bad crop of apples because their trees are in full bloom, and some of the surrounding areas as well.
And then you've got those soils that should have a lot of snow on them to produce the moisture when you want to do the planting, and it's not there. I don't know what's going to happen for the planting season this year.
Yeah. The other thing to consider is the longer-term effects of this sort of unusual warmth. The soils are quite dry now over a large portion of the upper Midwest. The entire state of Minnesota is under moderate to severe drought, although that was in place before this warm spell happened. But we've lost all of our snow cover weeks or even months early, which means that the soils are going to dry out much earlier than usual. We're going to be looking at potential shortfalls in irrigation water because the rivers are already at low flow levels, and they'll get even lower probably this summer. And you're increasing your chances of drought. When you've got this sort of early dry out, the soils don't act to cool the air above them so much because there's not as much moisture available. So we are definitely on the watch this summer for an increased chance of drought.
Well, maybe this year for once we won't have all the flooding stories down through the Midwest.
Yeah, well, that's the flip side of it. For the first time in 4 years, we're not expecting major snowmelt flooding on the Mississippi River or the Missouri River. I mean, last year at this time, there was still about equivalent of a foot of water on the ground in the form of snow up in the upper Midwest. And, well, that's completely gone now, and there isn't going to be major flooding. But the other problem, which will happen on those rivers probably, is they'll have trouble with the barges because the rivers will be so low that you can't run the barges. The navigation will be impacted by low water levels.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking weird March weather with expert Dr. Jeff Masters, who blogs at wonderground.com. Jeff, if we take climate change out of the equation, how would a meteorologist explain what people just experienced in most of North America?
We saw a situation where we had a ridge of high pressure move in over the eastern half of North America, and there were at least three natural causes for that. We've got a lot of patterns in the atmosphere that go by various fancy names. You've probably heard of La Nina. Well, that's an unusual cooling of the ocean temperatures off the coast of Peru. That helps create high pressure over the eastern part of North America this time of year. And in combination, there are a couple other patterns. So one is a pattern of Arctic winds that we call the North Atlantic Oscillation. And that was also happening to be in a phase where it favored high pressure over the eastern part of North America. And yet a third pattern of tropical thunderstorm activity called the Madden-Julian Oscillation was also enhancing these two patterns. And so these three different effects all came together and happened to create unusual high pressure over the eastern U.S. And those sorts of patterns do happen naturally, and we'd expect every, 50 years or so, we'd see these kinds of situations come together to make an unusually long-lasting and intense ridge of high pressure like we observed.
Do you think this start of 2012 tells us anything about the upcoming hurricane season or expectations of tornadoes?
No, we really don't know what that will hold in store for us this year. You really can't predict the long-range weather patterns more than a week or two in advance. And we can look at the ocean temperatures because they have a long memory. They go, months where they'll be influencing the weather. And we do see, for instance, in the Caribbean and then the tropical Atlantic, the ocean temperatures there are pretty close to average, which is quite striking because since 1995, that has not been the case. So it's looking like this year, probably hurricane season won't be as big a deal as we've been used to seeing since 1995 when those ocean temperatures have been quite warm.
All right. Well, on the question of whether this could be a signal of climate change, you referred readers to an article by Andrew Friedman of Climate Central. His piece was called Global Warming May Have Fueled March Heat Wave Odds. And that's what Dr. James Hansen of NASA has been saying. We wouldn't see these extreme heat events so often without those greenhouse gases we've been adding. What do you think?
Yeah, it's really hard to have this sort of off-the-charts anomalous heat without a warming climate. I mean, if you take the climate of the 20th century and you crunch the statistics where you take the average and then you look at how far the weather varies around that average, which we call the standard deviation, you can come up with some odds of, well, how likely is a type of one-week weather event like we saw, you know, to happen? And basically, it would not have happened in the climate of the 20th century. But now, if you talk about, okay, well, let's warm the average temperature by a degree or so Fahrenheit over land, now what are the odds? Well, 1 degree may not seem like a lot, but it really shifts the odds dramatically for extreme events, those 1 in 50 year events like I'm talking about. Those get about perhaps 3 times more likely. So that's why I say I don't think we would have seen this sort of dramatic heat event in the old climate, but it's much more probable in the new climate.
And also at wonderground.com, your weather historian Christopher C. Burt posted some neat graphics and a thorough listing of those heat records. I suppose our listeners from the Midwest or New England or even Eastern Canada can find the new and old records all listed there, can they?
Yeah, that's right. Although Chris had to apologize to me. He said, you know, I just got overwhelmed. I got burned out on records. And, you know, that's what I love is following weather records. There were just so many. This event was just so widespread and intense and so long that it was really impossible to get a handle on this and summarize everything that was significant and worth reporting. But he and I have both done our best. I mean, we picked out some of the highlights, and it just remains, he called it, it's almost like science fiction. I mean, the way we were beating these records, and I just saw a nice stat talking today at the Chicago Weather Service, that this would now rank as the 3rd warmest April on record, what we have going so far in March. So the heat is still not as intense, but still notable. I mean, we're talking the high temperatures are 10 to 20 degrees above average over a significant part of the country still in the coming week. So it'll be very interesting to see when the final stats are released for March, how far above average March was. And I'm expecting that we'll see a few states that broke the previous record for March by the greatest margin we've ever seen for any month. In other words, you know, you subtract off this March versus the previous record March, and it'll be like 5 degrees Fahrenheit. And I doubt we've ever seen a state break a previous record by that great a margin.
And I know, Jeff Masters, that we've talked about the number of TV weathermen who never say the words climate change or global warming when they're reporting on all these things. How do you think the media did handling this one?
You know, I didn't really see the media talking about this very much at all. It was pretty much ignored, and that was a little bit of a surprise to me, but I guess it shouldn't be because it didn't have that much of an adverse impact. If you get this kind of a heat wave in summer, at least relative to average, it will have a huge impact. I mean, it would have killed tens of thousands of people. But the fact it happened in March, we were fairly lucky. I mean, a heat wave in March is relatively a good thing, unless you happen to be a fruit farmer. So didn't get a lot of attention, which disappointed me some, but I guess I shouldn't be surprised.
But at least the common person noticed this, and they must be developing the feeling that there's something wrong with the weather and the climate, I'm hoping.
Well, it wasn't the first one of these sorts of events we've had. I mean, the weather has just been off-scale crazy in the U.S. the past 2 years, so just the combination of all these events back to back should leave one wondering that, hey, this isn't the climate I grew up with. And in fact, that's a phrase I used in one of my blog posts a week and a half ago when I was talking about the incredible early season tornado we had here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We had the earliest EF3 or stronger tornado in Michigan history that damaged about 100 homes near Ann Arbor. So, yeah, this is not the atmosphere that we grew up with. This is a new changed atmosphere. It's got more heat in it. It's got more moisture in it, and that's going to cause some significant effects.
Well, as we finish up, Jeff, is there anything that you would like to add for our listeners?
Fasten your seatbelts. We're in for a wild ride. And, you know, this summer, who knows what's going to happen, but I'm anticipating a hot and dry summer could set new records. I don't know. Another roll of the dice. The dice have certainly been coming up pretty wild in the last 2 years, and I don't see us getting off that roller coaster quite yet.
We've been talking with Dr. Jeff Masters. He co-founded the Weather Underground in 1995, and his blog at wonderground.com is one of the net's high-traffic sites. Give it a look. Jeff, thank you so much for helping us out again.
Okay, Alex, thank you.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Before we go to my favorite climate blogger, Dr. Joe Rome, I want to play you an edited version of this reporting by the American network ABC Nightly News with Diane Sawyer. It just goes to show, big networks can get the story right.
The U.S. government made it official today, announcing that this is the single warmest winter in a decade in America. And here's what it looks like. Two-thirds of the country, those states in red and yellow, have been abnormally warm. So warm, millions of people should begin bracing for the consequences around the corner. For one thing, experts say they are starting to see mosquitoes swarming way before spring arrives. And tracking it all for us tonight, ABC's Clayton Sandell.
High temperature records broken by the hundreds. Warm, moist air helping kickstart an unusually early and deadly tornado season. Winter was not only warmer, it was dry. The third smallest amount of snowfall in nearly a half century. The effects will be felt in the West. More drought that threatens water supplies. Drier forests that fuel devastating wildfires. At the New York Botanical Gardens, flowers are blooming a month early.
These wasps are just everywhere in this house.
In the South, insects are creeping and crawling earlier than normal.
Many insects are fooled into thinking that it is spring, and they hatch out.
Today in Pass Christiane, Mississippi, they're already spraying for mosquitoes. There was no winter frost to kill their eggs. What's happening to the climate fits the pattern that scientists have been telling us to expect as people pump more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
The planet is getting warmer, and it will continue to warm on average as we go into the future.
That means we're in for more extreme weather.
You just heard ABC News, one of the few major outlets to report what everyone knows. Getting summer in March is a big deal, and it isn't right. And it wasn't just in North America. The UK Telegraph headline, Friday, March 23rd, UK to be as hot as the Sahara this weekend. Britain hit 20 degrees C, a balmy 68 the day before, a temperature normally seen in June. Summer in March. Is it a preview of global warming? Our guest has a PhD in physics from MIT. He was a top advisor for energy efficiency and renewables in the Clinton administration. Joe Rome is author of the book Hell and High Water, but many of us know him as the world's best climate blogger over at thinkprogress.org. Joe, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's so good to have your advice. You know, the recent March heat wave in North America and it was even in Britain, it's hard to find words. How would you describe it?
Well, I think it is, as one meteorologist said, a really unprecedented event in all of U.S. weather history since records began almost 130 years ago. I don't think there's been anything like it. There's certainly never been a heat wave like it. You know, I will say it bears the hallmarks of what scientists have been saying global warming would do because it was very broad. It covered a very large fraction of the United States. It was very long-lasting. It wasn't just a day or two, and it appears to have broken 7,000 high-temperature records over a period of about 10 days. And it didn't just break records, but, I mean, it just blew them away, and we can go through some of those.
Well, the National Weather Service office in Chicago called the heat spell historic, but then said, quote, it's unlikely to be matched in our lifetime. And I thought, well, that's way off base. In the coming decades, this might be exactly what we see again and again. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's surprising. There's no question that the planet is warming and that humans are the primary cause. And there was a major analysis by the National Center for Atmospheric Research which said that if we weren't warming the planet on a given day or week or month or year, you would expect new heat records and new cold records to be the same. The ratio of them would be 1 to 1. In the last decade, heat records outnumbered cold records by 2 to 1. This heat wave, it was 35 to 1. I mean, really quite off the charts. And for the year to date, it was 20 to 1, 20 new heat records for every cold record. And that is, in fact, the average that's expected under global warming scenarios in about 3 or 4 decades. So this kind of heat wave is going to become, I think, pretty much the norm over the next few decades. And ultimately, in the second half of the century, which my 5-year-old daughter, you know, hopefully will live to see, this will be unremarkable and things will be considerably worse. And the last point I'd make is, you know, spring heat waves are not the ones that are devastating. It is the summer heat waves, obviously, because then you're building the temperatures on top of already hot temperatures. And, of course, last summer we saw the brutal heat on top of drought set the all-time record for the hottest summer for any state in both Texas and Oklahoma, blowing out the record that had been set during the Dust Bowl era by over 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. So, you know, I just think there's no question that we're going to see more and more of this, and it's unfortunately going to be pretty serious for a lot of people.
Yes, and I just read that the lost agricultural products, the cost of that has been raised from $5 billion to over $7 billion. Do you think this year's unusual burst of spring heat could affect crops or gardens?
Well, here in Washington, D.C., we've had the cherry blossoms bloom early, and you know, blooming early would be a risk to plants, obviously, if there was going to be a cold snap. It doesn't look like there's a cold snap in the forecast, but what it has done is set up wildfire conditions all across the country, and you know, pretty much in over a dozen states, we're already seeing a wildfire season kick in. So the head of the Forest Service said last year that global warming was extending the wildfire season, and that's what his scientists have said it was due to global warming. I think it's kind of obvious that when it gets warmer, that evaporates moisture, and dry areas get drier, and that is what creates the conditions for wildfires. And, you know, as I'm sure you know, there are some pretty serious drought conditions in a lot of places across the country, from the southeast all the way over to the west.
Well, you raised the big question that many of us are asking ourselves. Was this March heat wave caused by global warming? What are you hearing from the experts?
Well, you know, we've had Stu Ostro, who is the Weather Channel meteorologist, you know, he said that he didn't think there was any question that global warming was playing a role here. I mean, I want to be clear here that what causes the kinds of once-in-several-hundred-year extreme events like we're seeing now are a combination of the natural variability and then global warming on top of it. The analogy that people have used is it's like a baseball player on steroids. And so, you know, they start hitting further home runs and more home runs because they're now getting just over balls that were being caught in the outfield now get over the fence. So the global warming shifts the extremes and makes these kind of extreme events far more probable. We are going to have to wait for an official analysis, which I'm sure we will get over the course of this year, as to, you know, how much global warming increased the probability of this event. But I will say that Weather Channel meteorologist Ostro said that while natural factors are contributing to this warm spell, given the nature of it and the context and the other extreme events and patterns in recent years, quote, there is a high probability that global warming is having an influence upon its extremity. And this was the same point that meteorologist Dr. Jeff Masters of the Weather Underground made. It is highly unlikely the warmth of the current summer and March heat wave could have occurred unless the climate was warming. So, and Kevin Trenberth, one of the country's top climatologists, has a study, which I'm now going to post shortly on climate progress, a paper in which he basically says that global warming has simply is now influencing and affecting all weather because it is heating up the planet and putting more water vapor into the air, and that is creating more intense heat waves and more intense deluges and deeper and worse droughts. So, you know, I think there's no question that this is the kind of heat wave people have expected, and that it's far less likely that anything like this would have happened without global warming.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and our guest is leading climate blogger Joe Rome, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Joe, we all have news images that stick in our minds. For me, it was a farmer in the wheat belt looking over a bare field that should have been several feet deep with snow. He worried it would be too dry to plant wheat this year. Was there something that really hit home with you?
Well, I think for me, it was a couple of different things. I think these records, you know, when I started seeing that there were multiple places during this heat wave where the lowest temperature that occurred that day was higher than the all-time high that that place had ever seen. It never got cooler than the all-time high. I mean, that is just unbelievable. There were, you know, in Canada, there were cities that broke their April all-time record for warmth in March. That was one of the unprecedented nature of these records. The other thing for me, and I have written a lot about this, is the droughts, as you mentioned. It is through droughts that most people are going to experience global warming, because it is a very basic prediction of global warming. The hotter it gets, the more evaporation you get, and drier areas are going to get drier. There's also another prediction of global warming that certain areas are just going to see a shift in precipitation. So you'll actually get less precipitation and more evaporation. And we're starting to see that. We're seeing it in a measured way around the Mediterranean, but also now we're starting to see it in the Southwest. And these droughts are very consequential. They are devastating to farmers and to crops. And it's why food prices have been hovering near record levels for over a year now. And as you said, the Texas agronomists have upped the cost to farmers of their recent devastating drought to $7.6 billion. And one of the leading experts in Texas, a member of the Texas Governor's Drought Preparedness Council, said no one alive has seen single-year drought damage to this extent. And 2011 was the driest year on record. And so this is going to become the norm, unfortunately, in the coming decades, and people need to plan accordingly. And indeed, you know, part of the reason I write as much as I do is so people can plan and know what's coming, and their families can make decisions, and their children can make decisions, because this is not – global warming has been portrayed in the media – and especially by the, you know, disinformation campaign, as something that's very far away in time and is mostly going to affect, you know, poor people in Africa. And the fact is global warming is here and now, and it is affecting Americans, and it is affecting our agricultural system. And I mean, the world developed its agricultural system to support 7 billion people during a period where climate had been quite stable for 10 or 11,000 years within a very narrow temperature band. And people made choices about where to live based on, you know, amount of rainfall and arable land and sea levels. And that's all going to change this century. And quite literally, billions of people are living in places that by the middle of this century are going to be completely untenable in terms of their ability to support agriculture and in terms of sea level rise and other warming impact are going to evolve, and people need to start planning now.
But, Joe, people like going to the beach much more than they like to have a March blizzard. At first, millions of us are going to love global warming. I wonder if that's going to slow down action to save this livable world.
Well, like I said, I think heat waves in the late winter are not the most serious consequence of global warming. It does have impacts on people, because of the wildfire season, the allergy season. I'm sure you know people who, at least down here in the States, the allergy season has kicked in with a vengeance. Up in your neck of the woods, I think the bark beetle, you know, there's a new study that came out that the bark beetle, I had thought, and a lot of people have thought, that the bark beetle was proliferating because the winters weren't cold enough to kill off the larvae. And that's part of it. But it's also the case that because it's warmer year-round, they're now able to have two mating cycles. So you have this effect where you have less winter death, but now more reproduction the other times of year. So, you know, you're certainly right. I mean, I think right now global warming is only beginning to poke through. The beast that we are waking up is just starting to see glimmers of him. And as I'm sure you know and have reported on, you know, we've only warmed a degree Fahrenheit, a degree and a half Fahrenheit in the last half century. We're going to warm five times that this century if we keep on our current path of doing nothing to reduce heat-trapping carbon pollution from coal, oil, and natural gas. So it's going to get considerably, the impacts are going to grow and grow and grow. And like I said, it is not so much the winter heat waves you need to worry about, although they do have impacts. It is stuff that hits in the late spring and summer, but also the fall. And I, you know, as I'm sure you know, many states, many provinces, many countries count on the fall and early winter for the precipitation that they're going to use when it's drier in the spring and summertime. And this season had a record low snow cover. And record low snow cover is good in one sense because you don't get the floods, but it's bad in another sense, which is that you don't have the reservoir of frozen water that lots of Western places and other places rely on to humidify and the streams for water, for irrigation, and other forms of water use.
Well, Joe Rome, I feel like a kind of climate quake has just happened in North America and Britain. I'm hoping this will get people talking about it at least around their dinner tables. Is that your feeling?
Yeah, I mean, I think this weather has been so extreme. You know, ABC News ran two stories. I'm not saying all the media coverage is great. NBC ran a story, didn't mention global warming, but ABC ran two stories that I think got the science right. And I've seen a lot more articles cropping up in places like the Columbus, Ohio. Someone, a biologist, wrote an op-ed, "Anyone Still Doubt Climate Change?" Saw an article in a Wisconsin newspaper. So I think there's no question that the extreme events that we have been seeing over the past two or three years, the droughts, the wildfires, the deluges, have indeed, people have noticed and are now talking about global warming more than they were a year or two ago.
Yeah, National Canadian Magazine has a cover titled "The Year the Winter Died." Well, as we wrap up, do you have any new stories you want to tell us about or things we should watch for?
So much of what we grew up and expected, whether it's skating outdoors, you mentioned beaches. By the middle of the century, a lot of beaches are pretty, you know, they're going to be gone. So it's just this way of life that we have taken for granted. A lot of it's going to start to change noticeably in the coming decades.
Well, yeah, here's one for you. The Inuit, the people of the very far north of Canada, have to add a new word to their vocabulary, and that word is for wasps. They'd never seen them before, and now they're seeing them, so good luck. Everything changes. You've been listening to one of my favorite sources, Dr. Joe Rome, alternative energy expert and now the premier climate blogger. Google Climate Progress or find him at thinkprogress.org and drag that site to your toolbar, as I did. Joe, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Young climate scientists have heard enough from old weathermen and fake experts. A group of real scientists rolled out this quick song on YouTube. My thanks to VR in Colorado for this G-rated version.
I'm not a climate scientist.
I'm not a climate scientist.
I'm not a climate scientist either.
Yo! We're climate scientists, and there's no denying this. Climate change is real. Who's a climate scientist? I'm a climate scientist. Not a Clio finalist, no, a climate scientist. Dropping facts all over this wax. Be crying about a carbon tax. Climate change is caused by people. Earth, unlike alien, has no sequel. We gotta move fast or
were too busy sucking in Copenhagen.
Hey! It's hot in here. 32% more carbon in the atmosphere. Owie, owie, owie. Ice, ice, ice. Green sea levels twice by twice.
We're scientists. What we speak is true. Unlike Andrew Bolt, our work is peer-reviewed. Hey! Who's a climate scientist? I'm a climate scientist. An Anglican revivalist? No, a climate scientist. To the back. Like climate change on crack. Permafrost subtracts. Methane release is whack. Write a letter, then burn it. Deny, let's deny this in your dreams. Cause climate change means greater extremes. But be the norm, heatwaves bigger, badder storms.
The greenhouse effect is just a theory, sucker.
Yes, yeah, so is gravity. Float away, motherfucker. I'm a climate scientist, a penny farthing cyclist. No, a climate scientist, a Fox News journalist.
No,
a paleontologist.
No,
a clean coal lobbyist.
No,
a cashed up alarmist.
No,
a climate scientist. Yo, preach.
Find a link to I'm a Climate Scientist, the video, in my blog at ecoshock.info. It's not suitable for children.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
And now for something completely different.
Raymond DeYoung is an academic who isn't working for a military think tank or explaining why we should just keep climbing the consumer ladder. His localization reader will likely fall into hands that get dirty in gardens and active in your community. DeYoung is Associate Professor of Environmental Psychology and Planning in the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan. Raymond, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to be here.
We have so much to talk about, but for openers, I'm curious, what made you choose a different direction away from supporting that great big corporate system?
Well, actually, I, to be honest, I started out as an engineer, so I was originally supporting an industrial society and for a number of years, but I got more involved in the people side, on planning for people, getting them involved in participation programs. Anybody who's ever worked with public participation programs know that there are guaranteed way to make everybody unhappy, the public and the experts alike. And so I was interested in figuring out how to do that better. Went back to school and got a PhD in environmental psychology and planning, where I was studying, you know, the conditions under which you can bring out the best in people. How can we draw people into conversations where they feel like they're contributing something meaningful, and how do we get the kind of information we need as experts to help manage the world better? And that got me just involved in behavior change research and of all sorts of psychology on how the mind interacts with the world. And it's just been it's been for me an incredibly lucky change, because I'm having more fun these days than I would have ever had I stuck with my early career.
And, you know, I came upon your work through the psychologist Carolyn Baker. She passed on an article of yours about how to survive our knowledge about this society under extreme stress with a technique as simple as a walk in the park or something like that. Tell us about that, would you?
Well, and part of that's a foundational aspect of how to bring out the best in people. To understand why a walk in the park, or actually any interaction with nature, works, you have to understand how the brain evolved to deal with information. I don't want to belabor the point here, but there's some technical stuff, and there's two kinds of attention that people have and use every day. One kind that we're using right now is called directed attention. It's where we voluntarily focus our attention on certain aspects of the environment, of our interactions socially or physically with the environment. And it's a tool that allows us to shut down distractions or competing information or thoughts so that we can stay true to our conversation or our plan or our activity. Now, unfortunately, that kind of attention, this directed attention that we're all using right now, tends to fatigue. It wears out at the end of a long day at work or end of a hard week of work, and the result is an irritability, an inability to concentrate, a tendency to think more simply about things, not go below the surface. There is another kind of attention. It's an older form, or what they call in psychology a less derived form of attention, and it's called involuntary attention or involuntary fascination. And it's the kind of attention that draws the mind to the environment without effort. So it's at work when we're noticing a bright object in the environment or something that's moving very quickly or a loud noise. So if you find yourself deep in thought and you're crossing a street and then suddenly there's a loud horn and you immediately turn toward the truck coming towards you, that's involuntary attention working. It doesn't fatigue. It continues to work time after time. You can imagine that it has a large number of evolutionarily significant aspects. It protected us. It continues to protect us. It also has another side to it, which is it's not just loud noises and moving things, shining things, bloody things that grab our attention, although Hollywood and advertising is one of that. It also, our involuntary attention is drawn to nature. It's drawn to water flowing. It's drawn to large trees. We're drawn to the wind moving the leaves around. And so there's a gentler or a softer kind of fascination. And that's where this whole idea of walking through nature comes from. If we need to restore our directed attention, the attention we use in a lot of our everyday work world or socializing, then we need to rest. We need to not use it for a while. Now, a good nap will help. But even better, it turns out, is to get into an environment that's filled with involuntary attention. So if you get into nature, where there's just a lot of water flowing or gentle wind, or you're out in a field with rain flowing in the wind, using involuntary attention to a large degree and allowing the directed attention to restore itself. Now, there'll be a little bit of directed attention necessary to navigate, to not walk into a tree, but so little that you can really think of that as an environment where your mind can rest. And so in the modern world, we spend a lot of time in environments where there's a lot of information, a lot of distractions, a lot of fascinating distractions that just keep grabbing our attention. We have to use directed attention a lot more than our ancestors may have. Plus, in that environment, in the modern environment, there's a lot less access to nature around the corner or just around yourself. Again, our ancestors, if they had to restore themselves, they didn't have very far to go. Probably they were already out in nature, or they were very close to it. So we're not only in a situation that taxes directed attention much more than it used to, but we're also in environments that are devoid of the involuntary fascination stimuli that help us to restore directed attention. So we have to be a little bit more planful, a little more intentional about our restoration. And I think one of the best ways of doing it is walking more. Because walking, if you can make sure you pick a route that's through nature, through a tree-lined street, or through a couple of gardens or a local park, the moments you're there are going to be a little bit more restorative than if you had chosen the other route, which would have been a little bit busier or louder or more urban in nature.
I've got to agree. I use that technique every day. I walk among some trees or along a little stream near our house. And without that, with all the bad news I get about peak oil and climate change and the economic situation, I couldn't survive without that. Now, I've been thinking about another one of your concepts that you've proposed, which is muddling through. It's pretty apparent most people's lives are not going to be changed by academic papers or even a radio show host like me. Millions of people are already facing difficult choices about what to do. How will they muddle through it?
Well, I think there's two ways of doing that. They have no choice but to muddle through, because we don't already know the answers to things like peak oil or climate disruption. We know the problem, and we know what's likely to happen, but I think it would be incredibly arrogant of us to say that we have the exact correct way of living. That kind of utopian thinking has never really worked well, because it doesn't stick. People don't function well. Plus, I think technically we're not entirely sure how to solve some of these problems. How do you solve a peak oil or an energy descent problem when for the last several hundred years we've been growing our energy use? And so, the thing that's going to be most important, actually, there's a colleague down in Yellow Springs, Ohio, Pat Murphy, who says we have to make a lot of mistakes quickly. And by that, he means we have to do a lot of experiments. We have to try lots of new things. We have to, each of us, take on sort of an experimental view of our everyday behaviors, our choices, our interactions with other people.
we have to support that kind of experimenting, exploring in our society. So we have an explorer, you know, basically an exploring society. I like to think of it as behavioral entrepreneurship. You know, I'm sure you've heard of social entrepreneurs and certainly business entrepreneurs, but behavioral entrepreneurs are people who are trying to invent new ways of interacting and new ways of making choices. So if there isn't any master plan, and we can hardly expect that the powers that be, whether they be large corporations or large governments, are going to be able to help here, because in many ways this is a very different model from what we've all grown up to expect. We're going to have to try lots of things, and if we're really experimenting, some of them will fail. If they fail, we're going to have to be able to pick ourselves up and start again. So that idea of muddling, of trying, of being honest about what's working and what's not, and just moving on to the next experiment is important. I think if we can support people individually, as individuals or as families, as neighborhoods, and support the people who are trying experiments, it's going to be easier for them to try more radical experiments. Because nobody likes to fail, certainly nobody likes to fail publicly. So although we do need these people experimenting radically, so put that all together, we have to support these small experiments going on all around us.
Well, it makes me wonder, though, why is society so hard on those people who do try different ways of life and experiments? It seems like we're almost trying to stop that from happening.
It's a good question. I don't think I have a great answer to that. I think perhaps our society has, modern society, modernity, has put a very big amount of attention on success, on winning, rather than on trying, on exploring. So I imagine in the early days of development of industrial society, when lots of new things were being tried, lots of new experiments were going on, those people may not have always been treated as crackpots, as strange people. They were the modern people. But somehow in the meantime, we put such a high price on winning. You can't fail. You can't let this next quarterly report show any kind of a downturn. That it's very hard for people to start becoming behavioral entrepreneurs, trying new things. And so I think what we have to do is start to change that norm. Now, norms change very slowly. We have to do it through our own experiences. So in some ways, starting with young children and letting them know that it's okay to try things that don't work. You're not supposed to perform perfectly. So I think the educational system has begun a good number of decades ago. We begin to understand that. And so we have a lot more tolerance for children learning at their own rate, trying new things, exploring things with no need that it has to be coloring inside the lines sort of a thing. But I think it's because we've built a society that wins. And, of course, there's any one society that has done incredibly well over the last century. It's the U.S. society. Modern, you know, modernity really evolves out of sort of a Western industrial mindset, and we're certainly in the middle, in the core of that. So it may be here that it's hardest to get experimenting. It's interesting to think about things like the transition town movement, which started in the U.K., I mean, it's certainly taken off in the U.S., but it didn't start here. It started over in Europe. And in some ways, it may be that it's in the periphery of industrial, imperial society that we'll see some of these more interesting, more deep explorations going on. There's somebody in your area of the woods, Karen Lifton, University of Washington, who studies eco-villages, which are another example of some of the experimenting that's going on. You know, we had the whole commune movement back in the 60s and 70s. It didn't really take hold in most of the country anyway.
I was there.
me too. I was there, and I'm really sorry it didn't take hold. But the new version is eco-villages, both eco-housing, but also co-housing, but also just the whole village version of that. And her book on eco-villages is just inspiring. And it's the example of the people muddling through and trying how to, you know, craft neighborhoods, trying how to interact in very different social ways while continuing to live in modern society. So it's not a back to the land movement only. It's not giving up all aspects of a modern society. So they're not rejecting all modern institutions. They're just reorienting, retasking, right-sizing those institutions.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are talking with Raymond DeYoung from the University of Michigan, co-author of The Relocalization Reader. I'm Alex Smith. Well, good. Well, let's talk about your new book coming out with Thomas Prinsen, and it's about relocalization. Would you tell us about that? Introduce us to this book.
Well,
I can't help but start it by saying Tom and I have been colleagues for decades, and we meet for coffee at least a few times a week, usually in a small courtyard on our campus where we hide out for a while, and we've been having conversations about peak oil and climate disruption and consumption and environmental problems. The psychology of it is my side, and he does the institutions. And about, maybe 10 years ago, we got on to the peak oil literature and began to try to understand that, how it would affect it. And to understand what localization is about is we had both assumed, and I think most people do, that the challenge we're facing is trying to get people to live more environmentally sustainably, that it was going to be us, experts, practitioners, programmers, NGOs, that would initiate the change, and it would bring people to a more greener, leaner lifestyle. And when you step back and look at things like climate disruption, peak oil, energy descent scenarios, you begin to realize that we're not going to have to get people to consume less resources. They're going to be consuming less resources, whether they're ready or not, whether they're prepared or familiarized with the new life or not. And that's a subtle change, but it means that we're not going to have to motivate them to change. We're not going to have to persuade them to live green. They're not living that way now, perhaps, but soon now, circumstances will change such that they will be consuming less resources. And what they're going to want from us is advice, us being experts and practitioners and teachers and educators. They're going to want advice on how to respond, how to deal with an energy descent scenario drawn out over a long period of decades. And that's what localization is. It's a process by which you begin to get people's minds turned around, simpler lives and all, not because it'd be good for them, but because they don't have any choice. Now, it's not anti-globalization. It's not saying right off that we're trying to create a new movement that's against globalization, although it very much is the opposite of globalization. It's also not just about the local, about a kind of hyper-localism. It's instead a process that goes on at many different levels in society that turns our attention more and more toward local systems. I think the local foods movement is a great example. You know, it didn't come from on high. It wasn't started by corporations or by governments. Started by local folk. But it's not just about local food. It's about systems, about communication, about philosophies of food. And there's a lot of sharing that goes on regionally and nationally and internationally about this issue. So localization has some of those international, regional aspects to it. It's a little different than just, you know, a localist approach. It also argues that this kind of a challenge, the challenge that's going to involve a lot of that behavioral entrepreneuring that I talked about a moment ago, it's going to bring out the best in people, because people do well when they're challenged. They do well when their choices, their behavior matters. And this is going to be a situation where what you do, how you interact with your neighbors, how you prepare your family to live, how you prepare your family's budget to function over this energy descent is meaningful. It's real. It's genuine. And so in some ways, this is going to be an absolutely great opportunity for the human mind, because it's well adapted to this kind of problem solving. I don't think that the human mind is well adapted to affluence. We don't seem to be doing very well with it. But it did evolve through millions of years of dealing with these kinds of challenges. So localization actually has an aspect to it about a positive psychological well-being that sort of emerges out of this issue. You know, it lets people have a more fulfilling, more meaningful life at the same time that they're living with ecological compatibility.
Well, let's talk too. You said you've written an article called Adapting to the Coming Downshift, but I'd like to be clear, what do you mean by a downshift?
Well, we tried to think of a term that's better than collapse, because there's a great book by Joseph Tainter called The Collapse of Complex Societies, where he outlines 16 or 17 different past civilizations that went through collapse and finds that it's not an odd occurrence in human history, and there's no reason to believe that modern industrial society won't follow a similar trajectory. He uses the term collapse, but he actually is describing something called a great simplification, a dropping down to a much lower level of societal complexity. That's one aspect. We wanted to use a word that's different than collapse and try to find one word. And so downshift was one of the words we played with. We imagined driving an automobile and you know, you have to slow down. So what do? You downshift to shift to a lower gear. You're not collapsing to a lower speed. You're going at the speed that's appropriate. You're choosing the gear, the pace that's appropriate for that circumstance. Downshifting is that notion, which is it's going to be very important to come up with a slower, less energy-intense, material-intense pace of life. That's going to be what is compatible with the planet, compatible with sustainable existence. And so it's more of a downshift than a collapse. We also think of it as the downshift moment. It's the moment when people wake up or finish reading something or end a conversation, realize that they now see the world differently. That's what happened with us when we started talking about energy descent and other aspects of resource constraints, sort of an old limits to growth thinking coming back again. And Tom Prinsen and I both started out reading The Limits to Growth back in 1972, and here we are talking about it again. But the downshift moment is where you sort of internalize that. You realize this is different. It's going to require that I train myself, I teach my children, I interact socially in a very different way. And when you get to that moment, that kind of a downshift moment, it's hard to look at the world the same way. You'll see things that might have bothered you before as being very wasteful. And you realize, well, that's just not going to last much longer. There's just no way that that's sustainable. That'll be ending. And you begin to also see other things going on that you hadn't perhaps noticed in the same way. Side yard or backyard gardening, people, you know, helping each other, fix-it shops, all kinds of, if you will, somewhat lower-skilled activities, but where the people involved are reskilling themselves in old ways, learning old skills and modernizing those old skills. So again, in the food movement, you can see all the people involved in food preparation and preserving and, you know, all the excitement that goes on in that. It's a good example of how, you know, that's not simply a bunch of people looking for a hobby. It's the beginning of localization. And those people have gone through, we think, or it would be very easy for them to go through a downshift moment. So downshifting is both a process of adjusting your pace, right-sizing your pace to the planet, but also it's a moment, a mental shift.
As we get close to wrapping up, I'm hearing from you that this is something that might happen in the minds of millions of people, and then governments and corporations may play a catch-up role later. Is that what you're saying?
Very much so. I don't even know that all of them are going to be able to catch up, because some of what the change involves is just to move to a whole different arrangement. So it's possible that some industries, some corporate mission statements will simply make little sense. I mean, under an energy descent scenario, a number of things change. You have far less mobility, far less international finance. You perhaps have far less, if you will, entertainment, far less purchasing of services, and you begin doing for yourself more. You begin spending much more time provisioning for yourself, your family, your neighborhood. You're more likely to interact with people. So some industries, the entertainment industry, the transportation industry, the finance industries, may find it difficult to adapt. They may have to dramatically modify themselves. Others may find clever ways of localizing. I'm sure they're all clever people, and they'll try to do it. But in some cases, catch-up is possible for only some of them. And again, it's not like, well, this may or may not be desirable. I don't know. I never got involved in the whole environmental globalization debate. It just was something that wasn't part of my working on behavior change and the psychology of simple living. So I really don't have a strong position on, I never had a strong position in my writing or my research on globalization. But this is likely to change all of that, not by choice, but just by circumstance.
You know, I think we could talk for an hour, and I think we should at some point. Right now, we've got to wrap it up. Our guest has been Raymond DeYoung, Associate Professor of Environmental Psychology and Planning from the University of Michigan. Look for Localization Reader from MIT Press. Raymond, thank you for joining us, and let's do talk again.
I'd love to. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. I trust your life will never be the same. It's all changing, my friend. Set your clocks for a future not advertised on TV. Our background music was provided by Vast Mandana. Find more links in the show blog at ecoshock.info. Don't forget our website, ecoshock.org. Tune in next week, and please tell your friends about this program before it's too late.